Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Welcome to The Times. To find out more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
Hello and welcome to The Game, the football podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and in the studio this week, it's a packed house, which is good because we don't have to deal with a crackly phone lines and distracted phone guests. I can keep an eye on everyone and make sure they're fully concentrated. I am joined by Rory K. Smith, Alison Rudd, fresh off her appearance on the Neil Ashton program, and Clive Petty. In our debate this week, we'll be looking at some of the issues with fan behavior, racism, and sectarianism. We'll be going down to St. Mary's to see how Liverpool got on. But obviously, we're going to start at the home of the special one.
Now it's another corner to Burnley, and it's aimed for me! And the former Manchester City man may have just given his old club a huge helping hand in the title race.
30, 33, 43, 69. I have to say this about Jose Mourinho. The guy can communicate. The guy can obviously provide messages that are very effective and get his point across. I feel like nobody's really talking about the fact that the lead's been cut by 2 points, for better or worse. But we're all talking about those four numbers.
Ordinarily, you'd say that Mourinho, and there is a definite pattern of that, that Mourinho, when his team have a bad result, Mourinho comes out and does something else or says something else to distract from it, and it's normally very effective. I don't think that is the case this time. I think that he was extremely exercised by the incidents that happened in those 4 minutes. I think it helps him, obviously, that it means nobody's talking about the fact that they drew at home to Burnley. But I think he, to a greater or lesser extent, has a point in the context of the Burnley game that Chelsea were really hard done by. The thing that's a bit more troubling is that he does seem to believe that there is a conspiracy against Chelsea. And if there is a conspiracy against Chelsea, it is one that he has conjured entirely from his own imagination.
All right, you put a lot of issues out there. Alison, you're the qualified ref. Can we just maybe knock this on the head once and for all? Quickly run through these and see where he has a point. Minute 30. Ashley Barnes goes in on Ivanovic, sticks out his leg, knocks him over. Yellow card?
Yes, one of those. Could be yellow, could be red.
Could be. Could be yellow or red, not like could be just a
could
foul.
Be nothing. Or could be, yeah. No, because it's either reckless or dangerous, and you need to probably be there to see the speed at which it was committed. It was a hard one to judge with the naked eye. Video replays show that it was at least a yellow card. Yep, okay. He's correct there.
The handball in minute 33 off of Ivanovic's shot, is that one so difficult to judge with the naked eye?
That is a debate all in itself, because I think the whole handball is, it needs tightening up. I actually think we need some sort of FIFA committee to renegotiate how we judge handball. I think the referee didn't give it because the player had his back at the action. That's not good enough anymore. I think it's perfectly feasible to be seemingly to looking in the other direction, but your arm to be out and knowing that there is a very good chance that your arm will block the ball. And I think the referee didn't give it because the player wasn't looking at the ball.
Okay, but that's not a reason not to give it.
Well, it is, but I don't think it. I think it needs to be discussed how.
Okay.
Maybe all you could conclude is the referee has to be able to judge it because he's there and he can tell whether the player was trying to be doubly crafty or not. But right. I think it's a cop-out slightly. It's a cop-out that just because the player has his back to the action, it's not a penalty.
Minute 43, Jason Shackle on Diego Costa.
Oh, well, you see, I thought that was really soft. If that had been given,
really?
I think Sean Dyche might have been livid. Really soft.
And he'd be growling after the game too.
You know, you are allowed to touch.
Okay. Minute 69. Obviously, that's the Ashley Barnes on Nemanja Matic.
This is a deep philosophical issue because...
Oh, really?
It is, because the reason it's a sending off is because the initial foul was so disgraceful, and therefore the referee is in absolutely no doubt that Matic is retaliating in anger, and you cannot do that. There would be anarchy if you allowed players to take...
I don't think anybody disputes that Matic has to go.
No, but if that same degree of shoving at shoulder level took place... in a sort of one of those melees where lots of players are squaring up to each other, it could quite easily have been a yellow, especially if Matic had not been the player to have been fouled. It's as if the more hard done to you are, the more likely you are to see red, because it's quite clear that you are acting in anger and retaliation. It was a red, but it is peculiar that it's a red because he was fouled so badly.
Right.
If he's angry, he gets sent off.
But
the worst reason...
That the person who reacts against what is deemed a bad tackle quite often gets the harsher punishment than the guy who has actually
done
the tackle and committed the foul. That just seems a...
Alison, can you explain why it's a red card for Ashley Barnes, or why it should have been, when, as Clive said, he got the ball?
It doesn't matter anymore whether you get the ball. It really doesn't matter. In fact, they're quite clear when you do refereeing courses now. It's not completely irrelevant. There are cases. Maybe when we come on to discuss the Southampton-Liverpool game, we will see. But no, if it's dangerous, it's dangerous. It doesn't matter what you do with the ball. You can't risk a player getting a broken leg.
I find that unsatisfactory. Not in the case of Barnes, because that was clearly a horribly dangerous tackle and should have been a red, and to be honest, should probably be a red with games added on. There needs to be some sort of, from the top, redefinition of what a handball is and when it's a handball and when it's not a handball, because I personally am very confused, and I would imagine that goes for quite a lot of fans who are very important, players and managers. No one seems to be entirely certain when it's a handball. But I also think there is a degree of confusion over when a foul is a foul, and I think that needs to be looked at again, because at the moment it's very unsatisfactory, and that's why you do get this inconsistency in refereeing, because it's... Well, the rules change so much and there's so much leeway for interpretation. I do think, generally speaking, not in the case of the Barnes tackle, but broadly speaking, getting the ball should mean something. It should. That's the point of the game.
Sometimes it does, but sometimes it doesn't.
No, if it's clearly reckless, as Barnes was,
If you slide in 2 feet off the ground, stud showing, get all of the ball, but you follow through and take the player, that is a red card.
Yeah. Or even if you don't follow through and...
Well, in the case of Muddy the Waters even more, the foul where there is no contact whatsoever, i.e. as in Rooney case. Because I must be the only person who has some sympathy with... Well, I don't know, the only person I've seemed to have read so far has some sympathy with... Rooney's got to take amazing evasive action. And I just think the guy makes a sliding tackle. It doesn't get there, but it's not... Both feet are actually on the floor. Yeah. His studs aren't showing. Somehow, the excuse seems to be Rooney has to kind of evade him, as he would any tackle.
As opposed to Rooney has to run into this man who's 6'7" and weighs a million pounds.
To jump over him.
He did jump over him. And then he decides, I can't get the ball anymore. And then we decide that this guy seems to have been reckless.
It was trying to dress up as though if Rooney doesn't fall over, he has his leg broken. And A, you can jump over someone and not fall over. That is perfectly possible. But B, you could say the same of any tackle, that it's potentially a leg breaker. I think there is an issue now whereby, yeah, fine, I get completely that it can be reckless even if you get the ball, and I get that you sometimes it can be a foul even if you don't touch the man. But there's so many grey areas, and I think that this is a big issue with referees, that there are so many grey areas, and so much of it is not entirely clear and is slightly mutually exclusive, that we have a problem, and that's why we're getting so many inconsistent performances.
Broadly speaking, could they clarify more? I know it varies a little bit league to league, and UEFA also have their own directives, and FIFA have their own directives, but I think a lot of the stuff is pretty spelled out, and I think what happened today, or what happened on Saturday, is simply a case of a referee not seeing things properly. I thought it was interesting, and this might just be a theory of mine, and obviously without those incidents, Chelsea probably beat Burnley and whatever else, but rewinding a tiny bit to the Paris Saint-Germain game, Mourinho came out afterwards and said, well, first of all, they didn't play well at all in the second half, and I think except for Thibaut Courtois, could have easily conceded 3 or 4 goals. But he mentioned that 4 or 5 players on the pitch hadn't trained all week. I think he even named them. I think it was Willian, Hazard, Ivanovic, Cesc, and Oscar. Are there slightly signs of fatigue and that you're kind of paying the price for playing the same close-knit group of players all year?
That's the one thing that I think everybody's always said, certainly on this panel, everyone's always said about Chelsea, that Mourinho doesn't rotate. He does have a core of probably 13 players that he uses week in, week out. He doesn't even change things that much. I mean, the biggest change he ever seems to make is dropping Oscar. It's always, I'm going to change my team, I'm going to drop Oscar.
And Cahill now.
And now, but he's not rotating Cahill, he just thinks Zouma's better. They both have their benefits. But I think that was always possibly going to be the issue for Chelsea, that they might get tired as things reach a sort of climax. I would imagine they have the cushion in the Premier League. The issue may well be more, say, semi-finals of the Champions League if they're out of energy.
I mean, the cushion, of course, is 5 points, and I guess it's, Clive, it's one of those situations where you kind of do a cost-benefit analysis. The benefit of playing the same close-knit group of players over and over again is that you develop chemistry, which is probably important, because one thing I think few people have kind of mentioned, Mourinho went from a basics 4-2-3-1 scheme where you effectively had two destroyers in front of the back four to one where you've got one large destroyer in Matic, and then you have a creative, basically attacking midfielder playing deeper in Cesc Fabregas. So maybe because he had to find the right balance of that, he played the same people throughout, and that's why Chelsea started so well.
It's establishing a kind of pattern and a core that everybody kind of knows their role, so that if something does happen, perhaps mishaps like this, there is something, everyone knows what they have to do. It's hard to know whether you can actually survive in this modern day with relying on just that core of players. As you say, there's a lot of games coming up. I suppose it's what importance he's placing on each competition. Which is more important to him, the Premier League, I presume?
It's difficult to say. I think probably it is slightly. I think he knows he needs a trophy this season. The Premier League is the most likely one.
I would say the League Cup is, no?
Or a trophy that is likely to impress his bosses.
Mourinho said at the very start of the season, he actually got shirty with me for questioning it, because I think he was bleating on about how City have
Mourinho
so many...
Mourinho doesn't bleat, okay?
He doesn't
bleat. Sheeps bleat.
And Mourinho. And he was bleating on about... Bleating on about how big City's squad was, and, you know, the hinting that financial fair play wasn't being adhered to, far too huge. And I said, well, but then why are you so insistent? You want a very, very, you want the smallest squad you can have. You know, I only want so many strikers, I only want so many midfielders, I don't want to swell the ranks, because, as we've said, he likes a tight-knit group that he can control. Even within the top, this very small squad that he does have, he doesn't even rotate within that very much. It's not as if he's diluted it to the point that it makes sense to me to have one of the smallest squads in the Premier League for a club that's aiming for so many trophies. It makes some sense if you make sure every single player in that very small squad is top notch and can slide in and out really easily, so that it's almost imperceptible who's playing centre defence or up front. You've got top class all over the place. But even within his small group, there's such a gulf between his A team and his B team. It's different to any other club. It is quite staggering, given that they want to win four trophies.
I agree, and I also think this Chelsea team this year is probably the best drilled Mourinho team that I've seen, maybe since Porto, in terms of moving as a unit, tactically sophisticated, wingers working and whatnot. And so I think what happens is there's such a delicate balance to it that when they do change it up, that when you change a piece to it, when Schürrle comes on when he was there, when Cuadrado comes on, things simply work differently. And as we've seen, when they go to the 4-2-3-1, we saw it against Liverpool, we saw it against Paris Saint-Germain, that the 4-2-3-1 with like the two holding midfielders, it simply doesn't work as well. You mentioned the word conspiracy earlier, and I think Mourinho doesn't like using that word. He prefers the words campaign, and he used the word story after the match, and I think again when he appeared on Goals on Sunday. And that, by the way, for those who don't know, aren't fortunate enough to live in the Sceptre dial, what a television spectacular it was. I don't know how it happened, if it was just sort of the stars lining up, that we got to see Mourinho on Goals on Sunday. At the same time, you had Paul Gascoigne and Russell Brand on Fletch and Sav. And in the evening, we got one of the Gallaghers on Match of the Day, Noel, I believe. Anybody know why this happened? Is this like a special day in the British television calendar?
Well, I think it's to rival the...
Oh, sorry. And on Neil Aniston's programme, we had Alison.
Exactly.
It's remarkable.
So it's because it was Oster Sunday that that everybody wanted some real sort of drama. Now Mourinho basically spent Saturday evening saying he didn't want to talk about his he made the complaint. This is Mourinho's modus operandi. He makes a complaint. He then says he won't talk about it because he'll get in trouble, which means that the media have to insert square brackets and say this is what he's talking about, which saves him a little bit of money and makes it look as though he's not talking about it. What was different this weekend is that in some way he ended up on Rolls on Sunday. Now we can't be certain whether Mourinho called them or they called
Mourinho. Called them.
Okay. So Mourinho called them. They bumped James Beattie, formerly known as The Beat, whilst at Southampton. And Mourinho goes on. And Mourinho, because he likes a challenge in what I like to think will become known as like the 21st century Frost Nixon, will be Shepherd Mourinho. I think that's that's how we can see this going. He was on with Ben Shepherd and Chris Kamara, the one-time Bradford City manager. And one monologue, according to Matt Hughes in the paper, lasted 28 minutes from Mourinho, which is extraordinary. And I think
Sorry, I watched that, and I know it didn't. He didn't talk for 28 minutes straight.
It's in the Times. It's a paper of record. I think what the bigger issue there is not whether Mourinho ever spoke for 28 minutes straight, but why Mourinho wanted to do it and what he thought the benefit would be. Because, on the surface, it was quite a strange thing to do.
I don't think Mourinho actually believes that there is a conspiracy. Yeah. I think Mourinho believes in himself so much that he feels that when he's right, he's right, and no one is really quite of the calibre of brain in terms of football as him.
Yeah, and there's probably some merit to that. It is normally something that he does to detract attention, to build a siege mentality or whatever, fine, all that stuff. But I do think that the Mourinho of today has been undeniably influenced by what happened at Real Madrid. He's a different character. He's not the same. I don't think he's got quite as much control over himself as he did before Real Madrid. I think that changed him. It does look like Chelsea are suffering from bad refereeing decisions. And I genuinely believe, and I was at Southampton yesterday, that the more scrutiny we put on referees, and that is something that is led by Mourinho, he is the person who is doing most of it. He's not the only one, but he is the standard bearer. The worse their performances are getting. Correlation is not causation, obviously, but
that's a hell of a conspiracy theory, Mari, that Jose Mourinho is the sole cause of
increasingly poor refereeing. I'm not saying he's the sole cause. I'm saying that if you look at it objectively, what he's trying to do is not working. He's not suddenly getting the rub of the green.
I think there's a broader issue here. Ultimately, I think it's that there's a PR exercise at work here. If you have the manager of the team that's top of the table, especially on a global stage. I mean, people can all joke, oh, look, little Chelsea, they're smaller than Aston Villa or whatever, it's just Abramovich's money. But when you look at global metrics outside of England because of what's happened in the last 10 years, they are a huge club.
Absolutely.
If you've got the manager of this huge club with his fan base all over the world hinting that there is a conspiracy against them, it does not reflect well on the Premier League and on the powers that be. And I think it creates a climate, potentially, where if you're the Premier League and you have to sell this product and you want to sell a product that's seen to be clean and fair and people making mistakes, if they make them in good faith and whatever else, you would want that addressed. And this is why Mourinho gets fined. This is why any manager who complains about referees gets fined. Because or who does it publicly? Because the minute you attack the good faith of a referee, naturally the Premier League, the league which is a business and which goes and shuts you down. But I wonder if together with that, Mourinho isn't maybe hoping that somebody will have a word with the PGMO and Riley and say, like, hey, why do these guys seem to make mistakes all the time that hurt Mourinho? Why do these guys continue upsetting Mourinho? Why can't they referee fairly? And it puts a certain level of pressure on them where maybe Riley devotes a little more time talking to the referees. Maybe he's more careful about what referees he appoints. You know, I think this is the goal when you talk about this. I mean, it's not some big Machiavellian plot. It's kind of the way certain people operate.
But also, I mean, I don't know whether there is a sort of a graph to show whether he actually is getting the worst rub of the green than any other manager. I mean, he gets Chelsea's injustices, if you like, get highlighted because it's Mourinho and because it's Chelsea. But the very same weekend, Ronald Koeman has three or four and equally, but we're not talking about.
No, we're going to get to that.
Well, that's straight to Moreno. Possibilities here for Liverpool. Moreno's now found by Sterling. Target slips. Sterling! And that surely is that. Two shots, two goals for Liverpool.
This is our segue. We have concluded the Chelsea segment of the programme. Now we're moving on to Southampton.
And although you are my vast intellectual superior, Gabriele, I genuinely believe there is an issue here, which is that the more, not just Mourinho talked about referees, the more scrutiny there is on referees, the more pressure there is on referees, I think there probably is a correlation between all of that and referees making mistakes. And I think it's a specific form of mistake, which is the refusal to give a decision. Because I think psychological subjection...
You wrote this in your piece. Can you give us a quick sum up
and I firmly
about the
believe
context?
It. So basically, Kevin Friend, there were four decisions yesterday in the first half. There was a what would have been a soft penalty from Emre Can on Juricic, but could easily have been a penalty. There was a definite penalty from Joe Allen on Juricic, which was definitely a penalty.
Awful call.
Which was a terrible call. There was the incident with Mignolet where you could have sent him off, but it did hit the ball hit his chest first and then hit his arm. But equally, you could have sent him off for that. And it, Liverpool would have complained, but you could have done. It would have been understandable had he done so. And there was a Lovren handball that was a handball and was a penalty. Koeman responded really well and deserves a huge amount of credit for the way that he handled it, which was to say human beings make mistakes, didn't go down the line of saying we were hard done to. He deserves a lot of credit for that on a sort of human level. But in all of those four cases, Kevin Friend, who had a woeful day, and I don't like criticising referees, but Friend was appalling throughout. There was actually the worst one was Emre Can wiped out Nathaniel Clyne on the right wing midway through the first half in what was the clearest booking you will ever see. And he just waved play on.
Yeah, that was
and you could tell that St Mary's was kind of angry but also baffled because it was just obviously a booking. And I think all of those were non-decisions. What Friend did was not make a decision. And I think the psychological subjection comes into play, which is that referees know that not making a decision is probably preferable to making a decision in terms of the scrutiny and the pressure you get if you get it wrong. If you make a wrong decision, if you give the penalty wrongly, you get a certain amount of stick. If you don't give the penalty wrongly, you get an amount of stick as well, but it's probably less. And I think there is a real issue here about how we confront the whole issue with the whole thing with referees. Just what's happening at the moment is not working because standards do seem to be slipping. Everyone always says standards are slipping, but this season there have been so many obvious mistakes and so many poor performances that something is clearly badly wrong, and I don't believe it's that the referees have got worse.
I think Rory's maybe unwittingly hit upon the reason why refereeing standards have gone down.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Season, the intensity on the spotlight on referee grows. It's so rare now to get a show, any type of football show, where refereeing doesn't get come in for some criticism. How on earth are you going to attract top calibre people who could earn a lot of money being brain surgeons or whatever, to choose refereeing?
You did not just say brain surgeons.
You've said
Your surgeon for your thrombo today will be Andre Marinac.
No, seriously, like, okay, let's imagine I'm 21 years old, right? I referee on the side, if I'm moving up the ranks, and I'm really good at it, and I'm a really good referee, and I'm also a really good doctor with an actual chance of going to medical school and becoming a brain surgeon, right? You're telling me there is a single Premier League referee who's found themselves in the history of humanity, who's found himself in that position and said, like, no, you know what? I'd rather go and start down in the Ryman's League.
You want people refereeing you who are clever, who have the right skill set, who get it.
Yeah, and who are decisive and sure of themselves.
You can't think what else to do.
Right, but it's a talent.
Aren't even good enough to play football, want to be involved in some way, and so they become referees. And they're not particularly clever people.
It could also simply be that this time around, maybe, you know, the gene pool is such that you don't have a great generation of referees, or maybe you don't have a great generation of referee assessors and selectors. Maybe they made mistakes. Maybe there's tremendous referees further down.
Do you think this is a specific gene in the human genome for being a referee selector?
But I mean, that's one set of people. I assume we don't have to choose referees from one select. You lot are people about to be referees. They can come from anywhere. I kind of agree with Alison in that. I think season after season, as Rory said, the scrutiny of referees just becomes more and more intense. There's more and more cameras, there's more and more gizmos to show everything. The number of times you hear a pundit say, well, let's look at it from here, and from here, oh, it looks a penalty. But then you look at it from this angle, and for me, as soon as anybody says that, forget it.
I have a different reaction though to that. When I see that, I see, like, you know what? This is a really, really difficult decision because from different angles it looks different ways, or he's unsighted or whatever else. I actually empathize with the referee more when you have that situation.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I become.
You stop debating that. It was a tough decision.
And I don't think this season, actually, match officials are that much worse than last season. Did Friend and Atkinson have absolute shockers? Of course they did. I don't think. I mean, do you guys really think that the perception of refereeing is that it's really worse, or do we just talk about it more this year? Not compared to the 1980s, but compared to two, three, four years ago.
So, first of all, I'd like to say how much I enjoyed that classic bit of Marcotti dialogue where you disagreed with Clive whilst violently agreeing with him, which is what all conversations with Gab are like. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that there's a flip side to what you're saying. I think
he's agreeing and disagreeing with you as well.
No, everyone's right, but I think there is one other factor, which is not only that the increased scrutiny leads to more pressure, but it's also that the increased scrutiny in and of itself tends to highlight flaws. So the more cameras you have on a stadium, the more angles you can present to your viewers,
of course,
to say this is a mistake. As soon as you need two angles to stand it up, or two angles show contrasting things, then it's not an argument. The referee gets one, you can see why he's made the decision. But the more scrutiny we put on things, the more mistakes we find. So which is why maybe it is a trick of the light. Maybe referees are doing just as averagely as they always do, which is basically general standard. But we see more mistakes because we look for more mistakes.
Football wise, with some Liverpool love on this panel, it's a good result, right?
Good result, poor performance, brilliant goal.
You were there. Were Liverpool that bad? Because I thought Mr. Jordan Ibe was really, really impressive.
The players who emerged with credit were Ibe, Allen, and Skirtle.
Joe Allen had a good game, Sean.
Joe Allen was excellent.
Yeah,
apart from giving away the penalty, you'd be saying
he let his team down, wouldn't you?
No, because players make mistakes. Humans make mistakes, Alison, as Ronald Koeman once said.
I imagine it's fashionable to say, oh, look, Southampton are falling off, just as we predicted. But it seems to me they've quite a fair number of players unavailable.
Partly because they turned up for their lunch too late.
Can you explain this, please, for people who might be unfamiliar?
Mane wasn't. He was only on the bench. He would have started because he's been playing very well lately, but he was put on the bench as a punishment for not meeting the team on time for their lunch, for their pre-match lunch.
Okay, but it's also Tadic and Bertrand, and
yeah,
I'm sure there's others I don't remember.
Tadic is tired.
Gardos.
Alderweireld, isn't there?
Toby.
He's a big miss.
He's a big miss. Alderweireld.
It's funny, you guys really like Toby Alderweireld. It's interesting.
Why don't you like him, Gav?
Because my lord and master, Diego Simeone, didn't particularly rate him as a footballer.
I think he's quite a clever player, Alderweireld. He's playing lots of different positions.
He's very nice about Simeone.
But I'm just saying, maybe Simeone just had...
It's a bit mean, isn't it? It's only one way.
Yeah, Southampton are struggling a bit because the size of the squad, which might always be an issue, especially if you get injuries and suspensions and people being late for their lunch. It's more the dolls. So I've seen their last three home games, Southampton. And they did look like scoring against Liverpool, but only until Kevin Friend got involved. And then, but against Swansea and West Ham, they barely had a sniff.
So on a more serious note, obviously we saw what happened in Paris last week. I'm assuming everybody's seen the video of Sulaiman S. I think he was from Niger originally, but anyway, he's a black French man who was trying to get onto a train. He was pushed off once. He tried to get back on, pushed off again, and then you see Chelsea fans singing "We're racist," and that's the way we like it to the tune of the is it Little Peggy Sue? No, what's the
Well, it belongs to Crystal Palace, that tune. I don't know why they're using it.
It's a Palace song.
Okay, I think it dates back to the 50s, actually. At the same time, there's Stan Collymore in particular is really highlighting the issue of sectarian songs at Rangers, north of the border. I'm assuming nobody's going to come out and say, like, oh, this is a good thing. We should encourage this kind of behavior. Or indeed, I don't think anybody wants to argue that we shouldn't be policing it. Does anybody have any bright ideas about how to take things forward and deal with it?
I wouldn't lump together the two incidents. That's what I'd say first.
But Stan Collymore has, and he's played
the
game.
I don't think sectarian chanting and the Paris Metro incident or racism in football, where you get a gang of fans shouting at someone, whether they're a fellow fan or a passerby or a player because of the colour of their skin, it's comparable because it's give and take in sectarianism. You have your chant and you yell it out and they chant it back and it's sort of 50-50 and it's equal and it sort of meets and it fizzes and it dissolves and they just get on with it. It's not persecution in the same way at all. So I would separate them out as two completely different issues, and I think we're on dangerous ground if we try and broad brush this.
I would tend to agree. I think there's another difference too, which is that here you have a specific incident involving an individual, whereas with sectarian chanting, you've got a crowd of people singing something, but it's not necessarily directed at one.
Things like that. It's just what you do when you turn up at either Ibrox or Celtic Park. It's somehow that group of people, it always becomes, or they think it's become part of the match ritual.
There are people who buy tickets just for that experience.
But when they leave the
ground, it's not as if you walk the streets of Glasgow and it's a hotbed of sectarian. I mean, we've just had, you know, they were lauded for a fantastic Commonwealth Games. No one went there thinking, you know, I walked down the street and there was, you know, one half of the Glasgowers singing songs about feeling blood. It just only occurs that thing. Whereas the whole thing about the incidents in kind of Paris is, it still kind of happens, away from football. They just become a bit of a stronger unit. They feel able to do it because they're together there as one unit, and they've taken it out of that football context. And that's the dangerous thing about what happened in Paris.
I think that's a really good point, that it is away from... Mm. I mean, you're on the way to the game, but it is out of the football context. I mean, it could have been anybody on the street.
The thing about the thing on Paris is it's almost... It's kind of Twitter on tour. People get the anonymity on Twitter allows, you know, Stan Collymore, for instance, you know, only has to make one tweet and the racist element will just come out and bombard him with all sorts of stuff, and they're empowered because no one knows who they are, and there's a lot of them. It's the same with once you get all these people in one group sort of conglomerating as Chelsea fans. They feel enamoured to be able to do this. It's not as if they feel these things just because when they become Chelsea fans. They still have those feelings. They're just not allowed to express them once they're out on their own, when they're back in their office,
stand at the water cooler shouting, I'm racist and I like
but,
it.
Yeah, but suddenly you're in a group of people, you get empowered by that sort of thing. And I don't think we can divorce what happened from the outside of society, and that society is kind of changing. It's almost like someone decided to have some sort of nostalgia tip for the 70s and 80s in everything. So, you know, there were welfare cuts, people aren't as well off. Society is kind of more right wing in general, and I don't think it's any coincidence that those people now feel empowered enough or ignored enough to actually, when they come together, that's come back too. And I think it shouldn't be allowed to grow. I don't think we should just ignore them. You kind of try and stop it now.
They're not being ignored though.
I think there is a link. I know what Alison means about the sectarianism and sort of racism aren't the same issue, and that there is a big difference, but there is a link with both. So when Stan brought up the, and it's not, that's not something I followed closely, I've got to admit, not because I don't care about sectarian chanting, partly, I guess it's really hard, because you kind of know with that one, it's not going to change. Rangers aren't going to stop singing the Billy Boys, they're just not going to, because there will always be a hardcore that see it as part of their identity, and they've co-opted it into their fan identity. But the similarity between the two, I think, or the connection between the two, is that there's the whataboutery of the Old Firm. So as soon as you say to Rangers, stop singing the Billy Boys and we're up to our knees in Fenian blood and all that stuff, they say, well, what about Celtic? What about what they sing? Who gives a flying f*** about what Celtic sing? Stop singing it. That should be your response. As any organisation, as any club, it should be, it doesn't matter what the other side sing, let's take the moral high ground. But they don't. They say, well, what about them? And I think the reason that has become such a strong defence is because, in a weird way, the Rangers fans feel as though they are being
singled out
and persecuted and sidelined. And I think that, as Clive says, in an increasingly right-wing society, where there is this rhetoric about immigration and all that stuff, where those views are becoming a little bit more mainstream, there is a group of people that has been empowered to say, well, we're just saying what we think, because they perceive, wrongly, their views have been sidelined. So they are now claiming that... What I found... There was a lot about that video that was really, really odd. But one thing that I find consistently odd is that people could possibly think the word racist is a good thing. Like, you could self-define as a racist and think that's like a... Do you know what I mean?
Their defence seemed to be lauding... we weren't being racist, we were lauding a man for being racist. I'm thinking, what?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Chelsea did the right thing, yes?
Yeah, brilliant. Chelsea were brilliant.
Anybody read Matt Hughes's piece about... sort of talking about Chelsea standing by John Terry and juxtaposing that with the Chelsea fans? Or was it just me?
I think it was off the mark there. Off the mark?
Tell us why Matt Hughes was wrong.
I just don't see the logic in... Actually, Rory, I think you addressed this in the paper as well. So maybe you should, because I agreed with you. Okay. I just don't...
Please sum up Matt's position.
Matt's position was there's a degree of hypocrisy in how well Chelsea have handled the Paris Metro incident, because they were a little mealy-mouthed when it came to John Terry being accused of... an act of racism when he called Antoine Ferdinand something that was insulting and derogatory.
Yeah.
And I think Matt's point was, well, you know, they didn't suspend John Terry, they stood by John Terry, and in some way this has given succour to those Chelsea fans who might be of racist inclination, that they're at the right club, and the club probably would quite like them to show their racist bent sometimes. I mean, he didn't say it in those terms, but that seemed to be he was creating a link between the way Chelsea stood by John Terry and the way that it is now Chelsea fans who've been seen to behaving in an appalling manner. But I don't see the link. For the start, in a purely practical level, I don't see how any club can suspend a player who is accused of making a racist gesture or remark, because then it becomes a tool in football that if you want to get a key player suspended at a club, you just start throwing and banding around all sorts of comments. You can't suspend a player if he's under investigation.
In Chelsea's case, they had an assumption of innocent until proven guilty with John Terry, and they didn't extend that to the supporters, right?
I think my view is not that Hughes is wrong. I think you can...
Well, good thing he's not, because, I mean, you wouldn't want to say that, given that Matt Hughes went to a far more prestigious university than you did.
That is incorrect. I don't think Hughes is wrong. I think there probably is an element of the way that Chelsea handled the Terry thing probably did give a little bit of succour to people who think that way. But I think there's another issue, which is a much bigger issue, which is whether are these people actually racists, or is it the case that they behave as racists to in some way claim that behaviour because they think it's countercultural or something? I don't know.
There's no point debating whether somebody actually is racist, because you can't read their mind and you can't read their hearts. What you can say is, I won't tolerate any racist behaviour.
Yes.
And that's that. Enough nasty nostalgia. How about some quick hits instead? Manchester United fall at Swansea 2-1 and slip down to fourth place, even with Wayne Rooney restored to his position up front and getting his first shot on goal of 2015. Clive, are you any more clear on what Van Gaal is doing or trying to do?
It was hard to work out that Wayne Rooney had actually been restored. He did well to get his first shot on target, because I consider he was dropping further and further back as Van Gaal decided that his best tactic once again was to hit the big man and just lump it forward.
He only did that at the end.
It's like resort to that. This is meant to be one of the greatest brains in modern football, and yet here he is resorting to hit the big man. If an English manager had done that, he would be pilloried mercilessly.
Okay,
I have no idea. I have no idea, and I don't think what's more worrying, Van Gaal, but in February, coming up to March, and he has no idea what his best team is yet.
Thank you, Clive Allardyce. I actually thought United actually played reasonably well, but I thought Swansea, obviously, they got the points and they showed a lot of resilience. And I think they should get some love, also because we had a request via Twitter. First, we thought it was Rodgers, then we thought it was Loudrip, then we thought it was Boney. But they're all gone, and Swansea are still there in the top half of the table. Rory, what's the secret? Explain.
Neil Taylor. The secret of Swansea is that they have a long-term plan in place. They do not panic. They do nothing knee-jerk. They know what sort of players they want and how they want to play. And it's all very sensible. And I think there's a danger that you can become used to something so you forget how special it is. Swansea City have consistently been a top 10 side in the Premier League for 3 years. That is one of the most remarkable achievements of the modern era.
Well done, the Swans. Arsenal take all 3 points at Selhurst Park. Alison, you were there, and you describe it in your match report as a, quote, economical win. What does that mean? And B, were they looking ahead to the Champions League?
Yes and no. I mean, this is the way Arsenal play now. They cede more possession than they used to, and it's working for them, so they carried on doing it. But the Selhurst Park pitch was abysmal, and Wenger said afterwards, all the players' knees are sore, and so they increasingly just sort of stood still and absorbed. They didn't want to run around anymore, and I think that was partly in preparation for the game against Monaco.
Did you see the big banner from the Palace fans before the game?
Yes, it was clever, but I can't recall what it was. Think about
greed,
and the troughs.
There you go. Spurs huff and puff and come from behind for the umpteenth time to avoid a home defeat with West Ham and draw 2-2. Clive, Pochettino seemed to think your lot deserved it. Did you?
I'm not going to say any different. Yeah, there's two ways of watching Tottenham at the moment. They start off really well, create a lot of chances and don't score, and that kind of gives the opposition a bit of confidence and they kind of dominate. But what is great about watching Tottenham at the moment, and something you don't usually identify with Tottenham, is the kind of character and fortitude that allows them to keep going until that 83rd, 4th, 5th minute, and then they salvage a point, salvage more points from losing situations than any other team. So on Tottenham-like.
Manchester City romped to a 5-0 win over Newcastle. Rory, is it the best possible way to prepare for the Champions League? You seeing glimmers of belief that they can catch Chelsea?
Yeah, they kind of glimmer.
Or do they need a conspiracy to ramp up?
They kind of... Yeah, the referees aren't doing their job well enough yet. You see glimmers and then it fades because City are still a little bit inconsistent. They've got Liverpool away next week, which would be very interesting. Liverpool obviously coming off the back of Besiktas, City off the back of Barcelona. But yeah, in terms of the Barca game, that was literally the best game you could possibly have hoped for before the Champions League, because Newcastle made it absolutely piss easy.
John Carver not having the best time. They were terrible. Hull City get a huge win over QPR in the battle to avoid relegation as Joey Barton gets sent off. Alison, it was a weird one because Barton tried to play the peacemaker and then appeared to lovingly reach out for Tom Huddleston's privates. Barton has since apologised, but was the referee a bit harsh? Isn't that kind of normal behaviour, reaching out and touching another man's scrotum?
Well, I do it all the time. But
but that's only with your husband.
Remarkably, that specific sort of incident wasn't covered in my own referee course, but I think we're back to retaliation, and the referee was there, and the reason he gave a red was he didn't see it as a joke. He saw it as retaliatory behaviour, and that's why he got a red card.
Dan, I have a question for you. Yes, it's based on your excellent column today in the Times, which I recommend everybody should read. Are Palmer really going bust, and why?
Indeed they are, because they've had a succession. They've had a fairly mad owner who is the son of a very wealthy family who bought the club when it was virtually debt-free and then spent some money on it, not enormous amounts. And then the family cut him off, and so he started borrowing against future earnings, Peter Ridsdale style, as you well know. Except he borrowed so much and spent the money so idiotically that there's no money left, and so he just decided, I don't need to pay the players or the suppliers or security staff at the stadium or the gas bill or the electric bill. And so nobody's been paid since July. It's an absolute freak show of a situation. There's two options. Either the club just folds and don't play the rest of their fixtures, which would be horrible, or the league chips in, pays the players' wages between now and the end of the season, pays the suppliers, keeps it going, and then in the summer the club would restart from down a division.
Do Palmer still have about 200 players on their books, various ones on loan?
This is one of the reasons they find themselves in this situation. They bought a third division club. They bought a club in Slovenia and then stocked them with players that they bought. But it was all these sort of mediocre turdy players. Lots of weird questions about that. You may also note that two familiar places from the World Cup, Varela, of course, was Portuguese international, and Cebollita Rodriguez, Clemente Rodriguez from Atletico Madrid, who played in the Champions League semi-final. These guys rocked up at Parma on loan in January, which seems bizarre. Why would you choose an employer where nobody's been paid since July? There's also Albanian businessmen involved, and there's a lot of unanswered questions.
But my question was going to be, if they fold and they release like 200 players into the market, will that have the same effect as the Saudis maintaining oil production does on the price of Brent crude?
The price of mediocre, no-name footballers may well drop as a result. Well, that's all we've got time for this week. If you haven't subscribed on iTunes or Player FM, if you have an Android device, please do so now. Many, many thanks to my guests today, Alison Rudd, Clive Petty, and of course, Rory K. Smith. Check out thetimes.co.uk on your digital device. You get all of that free as part of your subscription. If you're not a member yet, you can take our £1 digital trial today. Just search Times Sport online. Bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.